Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Monday, August 10th, 2020. This is Section A. The front page headline reads, Council to Vote on Sports Complex Lighting Project by Stuart Doreen. The cost of creating a Scarborough sports complex that city leaders believe is right for Midland continues to climb. The Midland City Council is set to vote on Tuesday to add lights to the auxiliary fields at the sports complex at a total project cost of $929,225. The money would come from the Scarborough Sports Complex Fund. City leaders approved in 2016 the creation of 4 football/soccer fields at the sports complex with artificial turf at a cost of $4.5 million. Community Services Director Tina Yaws wrote in agenda packet documents that during the design phase, conduit was included in the plans to accommodate future lighting. When the fields were constructed, the conduit was installed. According to council packet documents, the light installation project calls for 14 precast concrete bases with integrated lightning grounding, 14 galvanized steel poles, factory wired and tested remote electrical component enclosures, pole length, factory assembled wire harnesses, 14 factory wired pole top luminaire assemblies, and 112 factory aimed and assembled luminaries. The agenda item calls for the purchase and installation of light emitting diode, LED, field lighting at the Scarborough Sports Complex multipurpose fields for a cost of $844,750 plus $84,475 in contingencies to cover any unforeseen conditions that may arise. The contract, if approved by city leaders, will be with Musco Sports Lighting in Lubbock. The city reported the fields are used extensively by children and families participating in sports such as football, soccer, and lacrosse. Since the 4 fields opened for play in 2016, there have been increasing numbers of teams using the facilities, Yaws wrote. Incorporating lights will afford the opportunity for greater use and will make the facility even more attractive to groups wanting to hold tournaments at this City of Midland facility. While the original cost of construction was around $45 million, the addition of features such as the auxiliary fields has increased the cost of building the complex above $50 million. Greater Midland Football League Agreement. Following the vote on field lights, the Midland City Council will hear a motion regarding the sports agreement between the City of Midland and the Greater Midland Football League, the use and operation of the Scarborough Sports Complex auxiliary athletic fields, and other related matters. There wasn't any other information in the council packet about this item. Engineering Design Manual. The Midland City Council will vote on an expenditure of $318,400 with Kimley Horn & Associates, Inc. to perform work to assist the city's engineering services department with project development activities for the planning and design of an engineering design manual. This article is entitled Petition Created to Protest MISD's Reentry Plan by Stuart Doreen. A petition that calls for MISD to offer in-person learning after 4 weeks went online this weekend. Katie Joyner started the online document that petitions Midland ISD Superintendent Orlando Riddick and the Midland ISD School Board to offer an option for parents, students, teachers, and administrators who want to be on campus. The petition reads, Do you believe that MISD should offer an in-person school option with safety precautions after 4 weeks? Do you believe families that want to attend school should be able to have that option? Those that do not wish to attend have the option of the online academy. Help us get school reopened by signing our petition and take some of the uncertainty out of the 2021 school year. The district announced last week the school year would start with at least 4 weeks of at-home learning for all students. Joyner told the Reporter Telegram on Sunday that the district's communication about health indicators that ultimately caused the shutdown wasn't what it needed to be, and that one piece of data, the positivity rate, should not have been the measuring stick. District officials specifically pointed to a more than 21% positive test rate comparable to Dallas, Houston, and San Antonio. Infectious disease experts recommend both a local positive case rate of less than 5% and a 14-day decline in positive case counts as conditions for safely reopening schools, according to MISD. Joyner responded to what she called a bogus number, as it was not 20% of the population. She said that while surveys were used to obtain certain information from Midland ISD staff and parents, the district's unwillingness to work with 50% of parents who wanted to return to campus has created apprehension across the community. In completely suspending in-person classes to help fight the virus, we've likely activated Newton's third law, Carrie McKean wrote in an opinion article for the Reporter-Telegram. We've jeopardized the safety and well-being of thousands of children in our community whose families do not have the resources, job flexibility, or social support networks to properly educate their children at home. The same week that Midland ISD announced its plan of at least 4 weeks of at-home learning for its students, Ector County ISD announced a phased-in plan that starts with the following students on campus on the first day of school: those who don't have internet access at home, those who receive services through special education, option to phase in with grade level, three-year-olds at early education centers, and children of ECISD employees, pre-K through eighth grade. Other students will be phased in over the next 3.5 weeks. If we don't go back and try, how will we not know if we can be successful, Joyner said. Midland ISD has sent the wrong message in their discussion with the community about not being able to have students on campus, Joyner said. She pointed to allowing extracurricular activities to take place, a decision she agrees with, and a slide used during a board meeting that showed the impact of at-home learning on parents. The slide is called A Day in the Life of a Parent, At-Home Learning. In the slide, the district shows a parent named Tammy, who has one child and works at home. The slide shows that Tammy's day as an educational support figure ends by 5:10 p.m. If that is expectation Midland ISD is setting for virtual learning, they are lying, Joyner said. It is completely ridiculous. I don't know how we can't push back on this decision publicly. Joyner and her husband Dave aren't calling for those who feel uncomfortable to be in a packed-in classroom setting. The goal of the petition, they said, is to have an option for students to attend in person. Their case was made last week by an award-winning MISD teacher who went on to social media saying she would have signed a waiver to be back on campus in front of students. Education is essential, Katie Joyner said. What is unacceptable to taxpayers is to offer them no options. Joyner said she hopes to garner enough support to show results at the school board meeting on August 17th. She wants Midlanders to think about if the bomb dropped last week really improves student outcomes in the community. We want as many people to sign the petition that we cannot be ignored, Joyner said. This article is entitled Commentary: Saudi Arabia Slashes Volume of Crude Bound for U.S. by Julian Lee, Bloomberg. For the second time in 3 years, Saudi Arabia is slashing the volume of crude it's sending to America in an attempt to force down stockpiles in the world's most visible oil market and thereby hasten the rebalancing of supply and demand. Weekly U.S. oil inventory data, usually published on a Wednesday and covering the period up to the previous Friday, is routinely pored over by oil analysts and traders alike. Despite their shortcomings, the figures give the most up-to-date picture of changes in the oil balance and influence trading decisions and crude prices around the world. Shifts in the flow of crude into and out of American ports can have a big impact on the level of U.S. inventories. Riyadh has clearly decided it's time to do its bit to bring them down from heights reached in May and June, when the coronavirus pandemic and the kingdom's own output hike combined to drive the fastest ever surge in U.S. commercial crude stockpiles. In the 5 weeks between March 20th and April 24th, the inventories increased at a rate of 2.1 million barrels a day, and by the first week of June, it was hitting new highs. Excess stockpiles act as a drag on oil prices, and the most visible stockpiles are in the U.S. because the Department of Energy's Energy Information Administration reports levels weekly. That's in stark contrast to other places around the world where the data are much less timely, if they are published at all. China, for example, stopped divulging official data on inventory levels in 2017. It's no wonder, then, that Saudi Arabia should focus on the U.S. This is precisely the same policy that it adopted 3 years ago, shortly after the wider OPEC Plus alliance was formed, and its first output deal was running into trouble. At the time, members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and 10 non-OPEC allies, including Russia and Mexico, agreed to cut their production by 1.66 million barrels a day from the start of 2017 to bring down swollen global inventories built up as a result of the first U.S. shale boom. Poor implementation of the cuts and rising U.S. oil production meant inventories kept on growing, despite OPEC making its first output reduction in 8 years. Fast forward to today, and the reduction in the flow of Saudi oil to the U.S. is dramatic. In May and June, tankers full of Saudi crude were arriving off the Gulf and west coasts of the U.S. almost daily, sometimes more than one a day. But in July and August, that has dwindled to little more than one a week. That surge in ships, which I previously wrote about, briefly drove U.S. imports of Saudi crude close to a six-year high, adding to the upward push on stockpiles. But it was short-lived, and imports in the last week of July were just 190,000 barrels a day, their second lowest level in a weekly data that extends back a decade. The figure could fall even further in the coming weeks. There are only six tankers carrying 9 million barrels of Saudi crude currently showing a U.S. port as their destination, according to tanker tracing data monitored by Bloomberg. With a journey time of about 6 weeks from the Persian Gulf to any of the major U.S. oil ports, that's all the Saudi crude that's likely to arrive by mid-September. And things aren't likely to improve much after that. In setting its official crude prices for September, Saudi Arabia has made significant cuts to prices for European customers, where it's competing with Russia, and smaller ones for buyers in Asia. But the kingdom has kept prices for the U.S. unchanged from last month. By doing so, Saudi Arabia is ensuring that its crude remains uncompetitive against domestic heavy sour grades from the Gulf of Mexico or imports from Canada, in a market where the hoped-for recovery in demand has stalled. The leaders of Saudi Arabia and the U.S. both want to see oil prices rising from current levels. The kingdom's budget still depends on oil revenues, and the U.S. shale industry desperately needs higher prices to recover. President Donald Trump might be quite happy to see crude imports from Saudi Arabia curtailed. After all, it would feed in nicely to his rhetoric on U.S. energy dominance. But once again focusing its output cuts on the U.S. market, Riyadh is hoping to repeat the success of the second half of 2017, when oil prices rose by 51% from a low of $44.82 in mid-June to $67.87 by the end of the year. Unless the COVID-19 pandemic eases its grip on oil demand, Saudi Arabia may find 2020 more of a challenge. This article is entitled "Land of Enchantment is Cure for COVID Blues" by Philip Brian Tabos, Bloomberg. In December 2015, my partner and I found ourselves on a plane heading to the American Southwest to visit her family in the rural country outside Santa Fe, New Mexico, some 800 miles from the nearest coast. Nothing but sea breeze could ever feel like home, I thought as we journeyed to the driest place I'd ever been. A lifelong East Coaster and the son of Portuguese immigrants, the sea was my definition of solace. But after arriving more than 7,000 feet above sea level, the drama of the high desert hit me with the force of a Broncos buck. It took one sunset, the sky colored with the pink and purple shades of an O'Keeffe painting, for me to understand why they call it the Land of Enchantment. And now, nearly 5 months into New York's COVID-19 lockdown, the fantasy of planting roots around our own adobe home on a dusty plot of land is what continues to beckon my soul. Hightailing it to the middle of nowhere might sound like a strange balm for months-long isolation. But we did end up trading our 850-square-foot existence and 8.6 million neighbors for four wheels, a 75-mile-per-hour speed limit sign, and cell service that flickered away with all our worries. The only catch? During our self-imposed quarantine, New Mexico surged past 17,500 reported infections, stalling its reopening plans and keeping locals indoors. So even though we're physically here, we're spending our time socially distanced, daydreaming about the moment when we can take in all the state's charms, from its native art galleries and trailblazing restaurants to its monuments, and of course, its many natural wonders. Here's what we've done so far, hint, not much, and what we're hoping to do once it's safe. After crisscrossing the country, our first stop in New Mexico was the rural artist's hamlet of Galisteo, 23 miles south of Santa Fe. This small community has housed no shortage of high-profile residents, including artists Agnes Martin, Susan Rothenberg, and Bruce Nauman. It's also where designer Tom Ford had prized architect Tadeo Ando build for him the 20,662-acre Cerro Pelon Ranch, which is about 25% larger than Manhattan and is on the market for a cool $48 million. Rather than request a tour from the listing agent, though, we visited another local, my partner's mother, an artist in her own right. We sat against her home's adobe walls, masked and beyond hugging distance, before unpacking our bags in her property's separated casita. From outside the windows, we admired the still-wet prints in her studio. Then we escaped the heat underneath a gnarled cottonwood tree and began to dream of what a life might look like here post-pandemic. The first natural step, we've decided, would be to pack a pair of mountain bikes and head to the cream-colored grasslands of the Galisteo Basin Preserve. With its more than 28 miles of marked cycling, hiking, and equine trails spread across more than 9,000 miles. Recovery, not just from the spirited trail ride, but from months of hunching over my laptop in a crudely made home office, will come courtesy of 10,000 Waves, a Japanese-inspired spa in the foothills of the Sangre de Cristo Range. First on deck, a 50-minute shiatsu massage. But we'll stay in our complimentary kimonos through dinner, which is more than acceptable at the property's izakaya-style restaurant, Izanami. On high seats at the chef's table, we'll order the five-course omakase with hot stone wagyu and sip on a flight of rare, unpasteurized namazakis. Izanami claims one of the most impressively curated collections of sakes this side of the Pacific. Being New Yorkers with a love for Western flair, we can't help but indulge in a little style hunting while back in town. Our first choice visit would be the Thrifter's Wonderland of Santa Fe Vintage. Along a nondescript back road in an unmarked motel-like structure, this appointment-only warehouse holds the treasures of pure Americana. Floor-to-ceiling stacks of denim, dozens of hand-woven rugs, and enough cowboy hats and boots for all the Old West's gunfighters. More central is Café Pascual's, a 41-year-old, 12-table restaurant draped in the rainbow strings of papel picado and dried chili wrist dress, a reference to the dish that made chef Catherine Cagle an early James Beard Foundation award winner. Her signature dish, Blue Lady Enchiladas, comes out blanketed in cheddar jack cheese and red and green chili sauce. Christmas, the locals call it. For dessert, there's a fluffy wisp of house-made lemon meringue tart that'll make you question just how much exercise you haven't done since the lockdown. If we leave Café Pascual's feeling like we should probably increase our cardio, we'll aim our gaze 2 hours north to the Taos Ski Valley, where you can get world-class slopes or hiking trails in the summertime, all to yourself. The Mabel Dodge Lujan House, a National Historic Landmark more than a century old, is a great place to rest your head just 20 miles shy of the mountain resort. It's named for a New York expat, like us, who became famous as a socialite and arts patron, hosting salons for some of the greatest American artists of the 20th century. Its 19 rooms are named for famous guests, Ansel Adams, Edward Weston, D.H. Lawrence, and outfitted with traditional Kiva fireplaces. One, the solarium, is in the owner's former sun porch. It's a veritable glass box overlooking the mesa. To this day, Lujan's legacy lives on in Taos. The town hosts more than 60 galleries and museums, but we'll head instead to the base of Wheeler Peak, the highest point in New Mexico, accessible via a strenuous 8.2-mile out-and-back hiking trail that cuts through the spruce and subalpine fir trees. A few hours in, at around 11,000 feet, we'd unpack lunch along the frigid waters of the Alpine Lake before doubling back to hit the 13,160-foot summit. The last patches of winter snow will remind us just how far above the oceans and away from our old lives we have come. From Wheeler Peak, you could see practically the entire state of New Mexico. It's a vantage that makes it simultaneously simple and difficult to see why we are drawn to this land. Living surrounded by a dramatic landscape means dealing with elements and all their implicit challenges. But it's also inspired centuries of culture and creativity. For that, I'd gladly give up the ocean. Native communities across the country are at increased risk during the pandemic, a result of high poverty rates, frequently overcrowded living situations, and poor access to safe drinking water and fresh food. Please consider a donation to the First Nations COVID-19 Emergency Response Fund, which is helping to mitigate many of those concerns. This section is called Region Briefs from Staff and Wire Reports. Midland. Hospital police seek burglary information. Midland County Hospital Police Department is seeking information about a vehicle burglary that occurred early Saturday morning at the Midland Memorial Hospital parking garage. Suspects in a blue Dodge Nitro entered the parking garage shortly before 4 a.m. and began trying door handles on parked cars. Anyone with information may call the Hospital Police Department at 221-2280. Austin. Three state employees killed in West Texas helicopter crash. Three Texas Parks and Wildlife employees died after their helicopter crashed in a West Texas wildlife preserve, the department announced Sunday. The group was surveying desert bighorn sheep in the Black Gap Wildlife Management Area on Saturday when the helicopter went down, according to a statement from the agency. It was not immediately clear what caused the crash, which Governor Greg Abbott called a tragic accident. It killed Dewey Stockbridge, a wildlife biologist, Brandon White, a department technician, and Dr. Bob Dittmar, a veterinarian. The helicopter's pilot, a private contractor, survived and was taken to El Paso for treatment, according to the department. The Black Gap Wildlife Management Area is near the U.S.-Mexico border in Brewster County, some 300 miles southeast of El Paso. The Texas Department of Public Safety, the Federal Aviation Administration, and the Texas Game Wardens are investigating the crash. The National Transportation Safety Board said it is investigating the crash of a Bell 206B helicopter, but staff are not traveling to the site. New Mexico. Man accused of driving impaired for the 14th time. Farmington. A Kirtland man is accused of driving impaired for the 14th time after being pulled over recently with a 30-pack of beer in his vehicle, authorities said. Farmington police said a 46-year-old Anthony Chi is facing a felony count of aggravated DWI. He's also facing a misdemeanor count of driving while license revoked and misdemeanor counts of failure to maintain traffic lane, improper turning at intersection, and no seatbelt. Police say Chi was arrested in the early morning hours of August 1st after reportedly driving in the wrong lane and struggling to stay inside the lines. The arresting officer reported seeing several crushed beer cans in the bed of Chi's pickup and a 30-pack in the rear seat and smelling the strong odor of an alcoholic beverage coming from the vehicle. A sobriety test was conducted and Chi was arrested. Chi has a preliminary hearing Wednesday in Farmington Magistrate Court. It was unclear Sunday if he had a lawyer who can speak on his behalf. Court documents show Chi's first DWI conviction was in March 1992, the Farmington Daily Times reported. Chi was sentenced in July 2014 for his 13th DWI conviction to nearly 4 years in prison with years of parole. This is the obituary column, Monday, August 10th, 2020. Esther Edna Tovar. Esther Edna Tovar, 56, of Midland, Texas, passed away on August 5th, 2020, in Midland Memorial Hospital. Esther was born in Fort Stockton, Texas, to Bilia and Simone Tovar on August 19th, 1963. Esther is preceded in death by father Simone Tovar, brother Adolfo Tovar, and mother Bilia Tovar. Esther is survived by daughter Nicole Hughes, Jeffrey Hughes of Alvin, Texas, son Justin Hummel, Brittany Catcher of Lubbock, Texas, brother Arnulfo Tovar of Odessa, sister Susan Caldwell, Tom Caldwell of Big Spring, sister Renee Lisa Marquez, Victor Marquez of Lubbock, and brother Alonzo Tovar, Donna Tovar of Clarksville, Tennessee. She is also survived by grandson Kyle Hughes, grandson Michael Hummel, and granddaughter Riley Hummel, and 15 nieces and nephews. Memorial services will be held at the Branch at NPW at Nellie Picklin Wells Funeral Home and Crematory August 12th at 10 a.m. in Midland, Texas. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Monday, August 10th. Three Texas Parks and Wildlife employees die in helicopter crash. While conducting aerial surveys for desert bighorn sheep in West Texas on Saturday, three Texas Parks and Wildlife Department employees died in a helicopter crash on the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department's Black Gap Wildlife Management Area in Brewster County. The victims include wildlife biologist Dewey Stockbridge, fish and wildlife technician Brandon White, and state wildlife veterinarian Dr. Bob Dittmar. The pilot, a private contractor, survived the crash and was transported to El Paso for further treatment, a news release on the agency website said. Quote, "No words can begin to express the depth of sadness we feel for the loss of our colleagues in this tragic accident," said Carter Smith, TPWD executive director, said in the release. Quote, "These men were consummate professionals, deeply liked and highly regarded by their peers and partners alike for the immense passion, dedication, and expertise they brought to their important work in wildlife management and veterinary medicine. Wildlife conservation in Texas lost three of its finest as they so honorably and dutifully carried out their calling to help survey, monitor, and protect the bighorns of their beloved West Texas mountains. We will miss Dewey, Brandon, and Dr. Bob deeply and dearly. All of us at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department send our deepest condolences and sympathies to the Stockbridge, White, and Dittmar families in the wake of this devastating tragedy, and continue to pray for the health and recovery of the pilot." End quote. The Texas Department of Public Safety, the Federal Aviation Administration, and the Texas Game Wardens are currently investigating the incident. Further details will be shared with the public as they become available. Vaccines and dementia. The story was written by Carol Cates, Chief Nursing Officer for Odessa Regional Medical Center. "I was talking to a couple of physicians yesterday, and we started talking about COVID-19 and the symptoms of loss of taste and smell. We know COVID can make people's blood clot more easily, so we talked about if that was the cause, tiny clots in either of those organs or in the brain itself, or is it some other thing that attracts the virus to those parts of the brain? Of course, no one really knows, so we were more than anything just batting around ideas. But it was interesting to talk about how interconnected our physiology can be when it comes to infections. Today, as I am reading and deciding what to write about, I saw an article about research presented at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference last week that linked flu and pneumonia vaccines with a lower risk of Alzheimer's disease, an idea very similar to the one I had been discussing yesterday, how the physiology of the brain can react to infections, or in this case, because of vaccination, to a lack of infection. Three different studies presented at the AAIC looked at Alzheimer's, vaccinations, and infections. Previous studies have suggested that vaccination have a protective factor against dementia, but no large-scale studies have ever examined it in detail. These three studies are a start in looking more at the link between Alzheimer's, vaccinations, and infections. In the first study, a group of researchers at the McGovern Medical School at the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston looked at health records of over 9,000 patients. They found that patients who had consistently gotten a flu shot every year reduced their risk of Alzheimer's by almost 6%, and that the protection was better the younger the person was when they started getting routine vaccinations. The doctors are not sure how vaccination links to a lower risk of Alzheimer's, but they still felt that it was significant that something as inexpensive and accessible as a flu shot had such a big impact. Another group of researchers from the Biodemography of Aging Research Unit at Duke University looked at pneumonia vaccination with and without flu vaccination and the risk of Alzheimer's. They also looked at many patients, this time over 5,000 people. They looked at the risk as it related to a known genetic marker that increases the risk of Alzheimer's. That study found that in all people who received a pneumonia vaccine between ages 65 and 75, the risk of Alzheimer's was reduced by 25% to 30%, and for those who did not have the risk gene, the rate of risk reduction was as much as 40%. The third group didn't look at vaccination. They looked at infections, far too often the result of not getting vaccinated. Their study was by far the largest, more than 1.4 million people. What they found is that people who have dementia and get an infection requiring hospitalization were 6.5 times more likely to die from that infection than those who did not have dementia, and their risk for death remained high for as many as 10 years following the hospitalization. They felt their research pointed to a need to look at the relationship between infection and dementia because there was such a strong link between those two things and risk of death. The researchers in all these studies felt some of the results were related to overall health maintenance and good health practices. People who get vaccinated on a regular basis also tend to see their healthcare provider regularly and have a better health maintenance overall. People who have dementia are less able to communicate symptoms and health concerns to their families and healthcare providers, which also has an effect on mortality because things are not always caught in the early stages when treatment is easier and usually much more successful. For me, the takeaways from my conversations of yesterday about COVID and how it affects smell and taste, and these studies and how vaccinations affect risk for Alzheimer's, is wonder at the complexity of the human body. We know so much about how our physiology works, yet we also know so little. One thing we do know, though, is that good health maintenance affects us in ways that are amazingly surprising. A good diet and regular exercise protect us from things as diverse as heart disease and cancer. Vaccinations not only protect us from highly transmissible, dangerous diseases, but they might be a good way to prevent dementia as well. Visiting regularly with your healthcare provider is the best way to make sure you are catching things early and preventing the things you can, and lowering the risk on the things you may have predisposition to getting. It takes advantage of the good health maintenance and all these surprising benefits we keep having revealed.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Tuesday, August 11th, 2020. Commissioners delay proposing property tax rate by Caitlin Randall. Midland County Commissioners delayed proposing a property tax rate for next year after some confusion during Monday's Commissioners' court meeting over changes that went into effect with the passing of Senate Bill 2. The main cause for confusion was uncertainty over whether the court would be allowed to later set a tax rate higher than what they had proposed. Last year, for example, commissioners proposed a rate of 12.25 cents per $100 evaluation and later adopted a rate of 12.8. But with the passing of SB 2, also known as the Texas Property Tax Reform and Transparency Act, the commissioner's court is no longer able to increase the tax rate after it's proposed, County Tax Assessor Collector Karen Hood said during the meeting. Several commissioners raised concerns over that stipulation, saying changes to the 2021 county budget, which will not be adopted until September, may make it necessary to adjust the tax rate. County Judge Terry Johnson proposed in his budget to set the tax rate at the no new revenue rate, known as the effective rate before SB 2, which would bring in the same amount of property tax revenue as the previous year. That rate would be 12.88 cents per $100 evaluation, slightly above last year's rate of 12.8. The county is estimating that no new revenue rate would bring in about $45 million in property taxes, County Auditor Veronica Morales said during the meeting, though she noted that was a conservative estimate. Morales said she expects the county to generate $38 million in sales tax revenue next year. SB 2 also changed the number of public hearings a county is required to hold before adopting a new tax rate. Previously, two public hearings were required with any proposed tax rate. Now, however, public hearings are not required if the proposed rate is equal to the no new revenue rate. The county must hold one public hearing if the proposed rate is higher than the no new revenue rate, but lower than the cap that would trigger an election, previously called the rollback rate, before State Bill 2. Senate Bill 2 set that cap at 3.5%, meaning if the proposed rate would bring in more than 3.5% revenue than the previous year, an election is automatically triggered. There was previously an 8% cap on year-over-year revenue before voter approval is needed. The Commissioner's Court last year set the rate just below that 8% cap in anticipation of the lower voter approval rate taking effect this year. The rate that would have triggered an election last year was 12.85%. Commissioner Randy Prude made a motion during Monday's meeting to propose a rate of 12.88, the no new revenue, despite the possibility of not being able to later raise it, saying he didn't foresee the county needing a higher rate, but the motion died for lack of a second. The Commissioner's Court discussed proposing a rate during the next regular meeting on August 24th, but they have until September to propose a rate, according to County Attorney Russell Malm. Council to Hear About Need for Field Management by Stuart Doreen. John Norman is more than a city councilman. He is one of the best football players Midland ever produced and a graduate of the Greater Midland Football League. Norman knows the value of having an activity to participate in growing up, whether one competes on an under 8 team or all the way up to under 14 squad. Recreation is important, and that is the same in football as it is in soccer, softball, and baseball. Norman is also a coach with the Midland Falcons. He told the Reporter-Telegram this week that his organization took four teams to a competition in Arlington last weekend. All the teams did well in the five-on-five competition, with one bringing home a title to Midland. Norman said he will coach teams that are part of the Permian Basin Youth Football League, a newer league that doesn't have the longevity of the GMFL, but will serve around 1,000 kids in its leagues. Tackle football, flag football, co-ed, 7-on-7, and girls' leagues. It is a great opportunity for boys and girls and would be better if not for the trouble of finding quality fields, Norman said. An item on today's Midland City Council meeting agenda is expected to give Norman the opportunity to address that. Leagues and parks. More than two decades ago, the City of Midland was looking for help in taking care of its parks and entered agreements with major associations in town. In return for those organizations, such as the Greater Midland Football League, GMFL, Midland Soccer Association, Midland Softball Association, and Midland Junior Baseball Association, running the recreational leagues, they would control field schedules at the city's parks. It proved to be beneficial for both, according to city leaders, who said this week that those organizations put their resources into the upkeep and promotion of their leagues. In return, Midland parks were used, giving the community's youth a worthwhile activity. Those organizations provide a report to the city at the end of each calendar year, and early in the next year, the council votes on new agreements. City leaders said while a new organization will pop up from time to time, the city has continued to contract with the same organizations because of their commitment to youth sports leagues over the years. It has usually been a good marriage and worked well, said Tina Jaws, Community Services Director. She said there have been occasions in other cities when competing organizations haven't made for better citywide youth programs. She said as the current agreement is written, the GMFL will go through registration, create its rosters, and then compile a schedule. At that point, it reserves the auxiliary fields at the Scarborough Sports Complex. When its schedule is complete, other Midlanders, including those participating with the Permian Basin Youth Football League, have a chance to rent the remaining available space. Can the system be improved? Norman believes a more equitable system is possible, something that is either first come, first serve, or at least doesn't put other organizations in limbo. A compromise with GMFL officials, he said, is preferable, but in the end, he would settle for a similar arrangement that puts his players, teams, organizations, and leagues on similar footing instead of having to search for quality space. He said fields across the city, including those installed by the school district at taxpayer expense, are either reserved by other organizations or locked up. We should be able to use the fields and parks set up for the city, Norman said. I know I will make people mad, but the current situation is not right. Scott Dufford, who serves on the council with Norman, said he understands the situation Norman is in as a coach. He also said he expects there is an opportunity for city resources to play a role in correcting the situation. He said, should the council approve the installation of lights at the auxiliary fields at the sports complex, that will allow more teams to play more games at the West Midland Park. Dufford also said he expects the money raised from drilling at Hogan Park can fund the improvements needed, including the creation of more football, soccer, lacrosse fields at that Northeast Midland Park. That would also provide more access to fields for teams such as the ones Norman coaches. If we have more fields, people will reserve them, Dufford said. He also said that while organizations such as the GMFL have given so much to recreational sports in Midland, he hopes they will do everything possible to work with fledgling groups like the PBYFL or a regional lacrosse league. Whether the Midland City Council talks about these contracts today, next month, or at the next Midland County Council retreat, there appears that there's conversation to be had to provide a home to more teams and the games they play. Odessa walk-ons to open today. Walk-On's Bistro and Bar, part of a company co-owned by New Orleans Saints quarterback Drew Brees, will be having its grand opening today at the Parks Legato Town Center in Odessa. Doors will open at 11 a.m. The first 20 guests will receive a Drew Brees signed mini football, according to a Walk-On's Facebook post. The Odessa location will be the first of two to open in the Midland-Odessa area. Work at the Midland location at the northwest corner of Loop 250 Frontage Road and Whitman is under construction. Brees was in attendance in May 2019 when it was announced Midland would be getting a walk-ons. Midland Brewery Tall City Brewery Company announced on Facebook that its beer will be available at the restaurant. The beer lineup includes 5-Hour Drive, Honey Blonde, Haboob Hefeweizen, 2 Degrees of Separation Amber, and Hop Up Camper IPA. Walk-On's is described as a restaurant that offers a game day atmosphere with southern hospitality, featuring menu items made from scratch using fresh ingredients. At the Midland groundbreaking, the restaurant served warm samples of its duck and andouille gumbo, crawfish etouffee, and its crispy cream bread pudding. Walk-On's also has locations in Lubbock, San Antonio, Waco, and Tyler. New coalition created to address road needs. Keep Texas Moving calls for private-public partnerships to build highways, by Mella McEwen. Texas economy came to a near standstill amid the COVID-19 pandemic and suffering the ramifications of a plunge in energy activity and oil and gas prices. But that doesn't eliminate the need to invest in the state's roads, according to the Texas Association of Business. The association brought its Keep Texas Moving coalition to the Permian Basin region Monday through a virtual launch via Zoom. The coalition is comprised of small and large businesses, local chambers of commerce, truckers, commuters, and local leaders seeking ways to improve the most gridlocked of the state's roads. Texas is expected to grow by 12 million people to over 40 million by 2040. The economy is expected to more than double by 2050, said Aaron Cox, Senior Vice President with the Texas Association of Business, TAB. Texas is adding over 1,000 people and hundreds of vehicles a day. The increase in commercial traffic is testimony to the quality of life in Texas and the economic opportunities in Texas, he said. We need to pay attention and bring about solutions to our transportation needs. Even though Texas lawmakers and voters approved two propositions dedicating portions of the oil severance tax and motor vehicle sales tax to highway funds, Cox said those needs have outstripped the available funding. Roads are not keeping pace. That was true even before the state was hit by the double barrel assault of COVID-19 and the worldwide fall in oil prices. COVID-19 and low oil prices are reducing the source of revenues, severance taxes, motor vehicle sales taxes, and gasoline taxes, he said. That is why the coalition is calling for private-public partnerships, known as P3s, to implement road improvements, such as tollways paid for by motorists who choose to use them. Under these partnerships, Cox said new highways and highway expansions could be designed, built, and completed years sooner at no cost to the public. In addition, he said they would create jobs and stimulate local economies. Midlander James Beecham, president of the MoTran Alliance, said projections are that the entire Permian Basin region could see an additional 725,000 to 750,000 new residents in the next 30 years. It's important to get ahead of the curve, he said. Though Cox mentioned tollways as a way to fund investment in transportation, Beecham said the vast majority of projects needed for this region are not viable as tollways. Still, he said, public-private partnerships would benefit the region, and all options, including tollways, should be available. You don't want anyone taking tools out of your toolbox, but you want people to be able to use those tools where appropriate. If they can use those tools, though it's not of use to us, we want them to have that ability and succeed like we hope they want us to succeed, Beecham said. Although it is home to only 2% of the state's population, the region provides 10% of the state's revenues, Beecham said. Our recovery, our success, has an exponential impact on the rest of the state. Beecham said he is looking for ways to connect the Permian Basin to regions such as the Port of Corpus Christi that will provide fuel for the area's economic growth. There is time to develop such projects, but the time is now to begin the planning process, he said. The pandemic has certainly had a huge impact on us all in a variety of ways, Cox said. As it relates to this coalition, I believe it reinvigorates us and lets us move forward in a way that can be helpful. We know funding is down, transportation dollars are declining, and the revenue base is declining. We need to deploy every tool in the toolbox that we can to make projects happen. That allows the state to utilize private dollars to build a lot of these roads that are needed and free up public funds for other needs like healthcare, education, and disaster preparedness. The Texas economy will recover, and when it does, traffic will be back, and I can guarantee it will be back with a vengeance, Cox said. That's why we need to address this today. Midland Fire Department reports improper storage of chemicals, source of ignition. The City of Midland said Monday that the source of ignition of a fire Friday night at a central Midland shopping area was improper storage of chemical products. Multiple Midland Fire Department engines responded to the row of buildings south and west of Big Spring Street and Scarver Drive. On Monday, it was determined that the improper storage of the chemical products resulted in spontaneous combustion, the City of Midland stated. City reports lowest number of cases for a Monday since mid-June, by Stuart Doreen. The Midland Health Department reported there were 100 fewer coronavirus cases Monday compared to a week earlier, following the most number of cases reported on any one day during the pandemic, 184, 1 week ago. The health department reported 84 cases this week, the fewest cases on a Monday going back to at least mid-June. The 84 new cases are reflective of lab results from August 3rd through 5th, according to the City of Midland. That is an average of 28 cases over a three-day span. On Friday, the 22 cases reported was the lowest number reported in one day in about 2 months. The City of Midland also reported the total number of cases during the pandemic increased to 2,676. That included 1,341 recoveries, an increase of 10 compared to Friday. Monday's report also included 837 isolated cases, 307 under investigation, and 142 unable to locate or refused. The number of coronavirus-related deaths stayed the same at 49. Obituaries for Tuesday, August 11th. George Forkurian. George Forkurian passed away August 8th. A funeral service will be held Thursday, August 13th at 2 p.m. at Nally Pickle and Welch Chapel in Midland with the Reverend Toby Castleberry officiating. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Cemetery. George was born to Robert and Era Lee Forkurian, August 3rd, 1943, in Stamford. He married Jody Ritz in 1963, and they were married 50 years before her passing in 2013. He married Kathy Fluitt in 2017 in Lubbock. He is survived by his wife, Kathy of Lubbock, sons Mike Forkurian and wife Heather of Midland, and Steve Forkurian and wife Tammy of Midland, as well as 5 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren. He is also survived by 2 stepsons, Patrick Fluitt of Post and Daniel Fluitt of Knoxville, Tennessee. Donations can be made in his memory to Hospice of Lubbock. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Johnny Pat Beck. Johnny Pat Beck, 72, of Midland, passed away Friday, July 31st. He was born to Richard E. and Lita Jean Skipworth Beck in Vernon, October 8, 1947. Surviving him are his wife, Susan C. Bridges Beck of Midland, five children, Clint Beck and wife Tammy, Jonna Swopes and husband Jason, and Gina Witten and husband Zeno, all of Midland, Nicole Wright and husband Sam of Manchester, New Hampshire, and Leah Bermudez and husband Ed of Georgetown, seven grandchildren, one great-granddaughter, his sister Pam Ronimus of Winters, along with her children and grandchildren. He is preceded in death by his parents, Richard E. and Lita Jean Skipwork Beth of Snyder. Memorial services at this moment are postponed. The family will provide details at a later date. Arrangements are entrusted to Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa, and condolences may be sent to the family online at acreswestfuneral.com. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to St. Jude's Children's Hospital. Death notice. Malachi Andrew Zane Mitchell. Malachi Andrew Zane Mitchell, 20, of Midland, passed away August 6th. He was born January 1st, 2020, to Kenneth Mitchell and Michelle Watson. He is survived by his son, Julian Mitchell, and mother of his son, Noel McDaniel, his parents, and six siblings. Viewing will be held Tuesday, August 11th, between 10 a.m., beginning at 10 a.m., with a service immediately following at 2 p.m. Arrangements are entrusted to American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory of Midland.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.